Hello, I'm Dominic Gerard, and I'm reading A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Stave 1. Marley was dead, to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it. And Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. Mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade. But the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hand shall not disturb it, or the country's done for. You will therefore permit me to repeat emphatically that Marley was as dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead. Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole administrator, his sole assign, his sole residuary legatee, his sole friend, and sole mourner. And even Scrooge was not so dreadfully cut up by the sad event, but that he was an excellent man of business on the very day of the funeral, and solemnized it with an undoubted bargain. The mention of Marley's funeral brings me back to the point I started from. There is no doubt that Marley was dead. This must be distinctly understood, or nothing wonderful can come of the story I am going to relate. If we were not perfectly convinced that Hamlet's father died before the play began, there would be nothing more remarkable in his taking a stroll at night in an easterly wind upon his own ramparts than there would be in any other middle-aged gentleman rashly turning out after dark in a breezy spot, say, St. Paul's Churchyard, for instance, literally to astonish his son's weak mind. Scrooge never painted out old Marley's name. There it stood, years afterwards, above the warehouse door, Scrooge and Marley. The firm was known as Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge Scrooge, and sometimes Marley, but he answered to both names. It was all the same to him. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head, and on his eyebrows, and on his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days, and didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. External heat and cold had little influence on Scrooge. No warmth could warm, no wintry weather chill him. No wind that blew was bitterer than he. No falling snow was more intent upon its purpose. No pelting rain less open to entreaty. Foul weather didn't know where to have him. The heaviest rain and snow and hail and sleet could boast of the advantage over him in only one respect. They often came down handsomely, and Scrooge never did. Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say with gladsome looks, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to see me?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what it was o'clock. No man or woman ever once in all his life inquired the way to such and such a place of Scrooge. Even the blind men's dogs appeared to know him, and when they saw him coming on, would tug their owners into doorways and up courts, and then would wag their tails as though they said, "No eye at all is better than an evil eye, dark master." But what did Scrooge care? It was the very thing he liked. To edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance, was what the knowing ones call nuts to Scrooge. Once upon a time, Of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was cold, bleak, biting weather, foggy withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts and stamping their feet upon the pavement stones to warm them. The city clocks had only just gone 3, but it was quite dark already. It had not been light all day, and candles were flaring in the windows of the neighbouring offices like ruddy smears upon the palpable brown air. The fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole, and was so dense without that although the court was of the narrowest, the houses opposite were mere phantoms. To see the dingy cloud come drooping down, obscuring everything, one might have thought that nature lived hard by and was brewing on a large scale. The door of Scrooge's counting house was open, that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who, in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room, and so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of a strong imagination, he failed.
"A Merry Christmas, Uncle! God save you!" cried a cheerful voice. It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimation he had of his approach.
"Bah!" said Scrooge. "Humbug!"
He had so heated himself with rapid walking in the fog and frost, this nephew of Scrooge's, that he was all in a glow. His face was ruddy and handsome, his eyes sparkled, and his breath smoked again.
"Christmas a humbug, Uncle?" said Scrooge's nephew. "You don't mean that, I'm sure."
"I do," said Scrooge. "Merry Christmas. What right have you to be merry? What reason have you to be merry? You're poor enough."
"Come then," returned the nephew gaily. "What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose? You're rich enough."
Scrooge, having no better answer ready on the spur of the moment, said,
"Bah!"
again, and followed it up with,
"Humbug."
"Don't be cross, Uncle," said the nephew.
"What else can I be," returned the uncle, "when I live in such a world of fools as this? Merry Christmas. Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older but not an hour richer? A time for balancing your books and having every item in them through a round dozen of months presented dead against you? If I could work my will," said Scrooge indignantly, "every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He should."
"Uncle," pleaded the nephew.
"Nephew," returned the uncle sternly, "keep Christmas in your own way and let me keep it in mine."
"Keep it?" repeated Scrooge's nephew. "But you don't keep it."
"Let me leave it alone then," said Scrooge. "Much good may it do you. Much good has it ever done you."
My name is Dominic Gerard. This is 1599, A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, by James Shapiro. Prologue. The weather in London in December 1598 had been frigid. So cold that 10 days before New Year the Thames was nearly frozen over at London Bridge. It thawed just before Christmas, and hardy playgoers flocked to the outdoor Rose Playhouse in Southwark in record numbers. But the weather turned freezing cold again on St. John's Day, the 27th, and a great snowstorm blanketed London on the 28th of December. As the snow fell, a dozen or so armed men gathered in Shoreditch in London's northern suburbs. Instead of the clubs, usually wielded in London's street brawls or apprentice riots, they carried deadly weapons, swords, daggers, bills, axes and such like. Other than the Tower of London, which housed England's arsenal, about the only places to come by some of the larger weapons were the public theatres, where they were used to give a touch of realism to staged combat. In all likelihood,
These weapons were borrowed from the Curtain Playhouse near Finsbury Field, temporary home of the Chamberlain's men. The armed men didn't have far to go. Their destination was another playhouse in Shoreditch, the nearby theatre. The theatre, built in 1576, was London's oldest and most celebrated playhouse, nursery of the great drama of Thomas Kyd, Christopher Marlowe, and Shakespeare. It was here, a few years earlier, that audiences had heard the ghost who cried so miserably at the theatre like an oyster wife, Hamlet, revenge! Not Shakespeare's play, but an earlier, now lost Hamlet. As the men approached the hulking building, the theatre itself must have seemed a ghostly presence, vacant now for 2 years in the aftermath of a fallout between the Chamberlain's men and their prickly landlord, Giles Allen. Local residents, seeing the armed troop approach, may well have been confused about what was happening during this week of holiday revels, for at the head of the group was the leading tragedian in England, the charismatic star of the Chamberlain's men, Richard Burbage. But this was no impromptu piece of street theatre. Burbage, his older brother Cuthbert, and the rest of the men bearing weapons were there in deadly earnest, about to trespass and take back what they considered rightfully theirs and, if necessary, come to blows with anyone trying to stop them. The Chamberlain's men were in trouble, and the only way out was to get in a bit deeper. Things had begun to go wrong 2 years earlier when James Burbage, Richard and Cuthbert's father and the man who had built the theatre, had decided to build an indoor stage in the wealthy London neighbourhood of Blackfriars. The venue would have enabled his son Richard and the other shareholders of the Chamberlain's men to act year-round for a more upmarket and better-paying clientele, providing more security than they had had at the theatre, where the lease was expiring. James Burbage had sunk the considerable sum of £600 into the venture. As the Blackfriars Theatre neared completion, influential neighbours who were worried about the noise and riffraff that the theatre might attract had succeeded in having playing banned there. James Burbage had died soon after, having also failed to renegotiate an extension on his lease at the theatre. His sons, Richard and Cuthbert, had no better luck changing Giles Allen's mind. With the Burbages' capital tied up at Blackfriars, and the theatre now in Allen's hands, the Chamberlain's men, lacking a permanent playing space, were in danger of becoming homeless. By early December, Richard Burbage had quietly approached five of his fellow actor shareholders in the company, William Shakespeare, John Hemmings, Augustine Phillips, Thomas Pope, and Will Kemp, with a plan. The first thing they needed to do was find a new site for a theatre, one that was accessible to London's playgoers, but outside the city limits, where playhouses weren't subject to the authority of the often hostile city fathers. Members of the company, probably Hemmings and Condell, who lived in the parish of St. Mary, Aldermanbury, had learned that a neighbour, Sir Nicholas Brend, was looking to rent some land in Southwark. The property was a stone's throw from the Rose Theatre, home of their main rivals, the Admiral's men. The Chamberlain's men quickly came to terms with Brend, securing an inexpensive 31-year lease, which was theirs from Christmas Day. The transaction was rushed, and it wasn't until late February that the paperwork was completed.